the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Paul's been really helpful, in fact, in giving us that little intro. He's thought about contact, and he picked up on Johnny's verse. We're going to get there again as well in a few minutes. Now, if you've just joined us for today, or if this is your first time, or if you're one of those lovely contact records, I've just realized that Paul and I arrived at Belmont in the year 2000. That means Pete Bucks must have been the contact worker, and amazingly I stayed. So it's remarkable, isn't it? It's remarkable. But if this is your first time, we are actually in part four of a five-part series called Making Disciples. As you've just heard from Esther, apparently. Yeah, she is at the church where Chris Rogers, the writer of the material that we're using for our home groups this term, is the vicar. So we're on part four of five, and we have a sincere desire here, don't we, at Belmont Chapel to help people to come to know who Jesus is. We passionately believe that there's a God who made us. We passionately believe there's a God who knows us. And we passionately believe there's a God who loves us. And so as followers of Jesus, as those who are his disciples, we're tasked to go and tell other people. That is what we're told to do. The final words of Matthew's account of Jesus' life, we discover Jesus making these comments: "Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, of the Son, of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely, I am with you always to the very end of the age." And during this series, we're exploring how being a follower of Jesus means that it has to have an effect upon our head and our hearts and our hands. And we've looked at the first two areas already. And we've learned, of course, that being a disciple is closely linked to who or what it is that we worship. And together we considered the why and the what and the how of worship by examining in detail the first two verses of chapter 12 of Paul's letter to the church in Rome. Interestingly, the verse that was just quoted by Paul. And then last week, we thought about what kinds of hearts we have with the help of a few verses from the Old Testament, from Ezekiel, and Johnny helped us. We asked ourselves whether we are half-hearted or hard-hearted or whole-hearted in our outlook and in our behavior towards God. So that moves us on today. We're going to look at the third H. We're going to look at hands. In the start of the session three in Chris Rogers' book, Making Disciples, the one that we're using in our home groups, this is what he has to say. He says, "Making the connection between what our head knows, what our heart longs for, is the key to getting our hands serving Jesus." I'll read that again. "Making the connection between what our head knows, what our heart longs for, is the key to getting our hands serving Jesus." And as we saw in our introductory talk, the foundation for this sort of 3H approach finds its roots in the Old Testament, and it finds its roots as well in Jesus' restating of the Shema, that prayer that all Orthodox Jews make at least twice a day. We find the words as Jesus restates it in Mark chapter 12. This is what we find. If you remember the context, a lawyer comes and asks Jesus and says, "What's the greatest commandment?" And Jesus says this: "The most important one is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength. The second is this: Love your neighbor as yourself." The verses we're going to look at together in a few moments come from the early part of the book of Exodus. You may want to just find them. If you've got a green church Bible, there's one in front of you. If you'd like to find the passage, that'd be really helpful. Now, I'm going to make an assumption here that at least most of us have some working knowledge of the story of Moses. Now, if you were here over the summer, you may remember that Miriam was one of our God's champions. And Miriam, of course, was Moses' sister. And we talked about that inauspicious start to life that Moses had. Cast adrift in a basket onto the River Nile in a homemade basket because his Hebrew family feared the outcome of an edict that was issued by the reigning Pharaoh, a pogrom of infanticide designed, of course, to rid the nation of all newborn Hebrew male children. But as we learned, God's hand was at work. And so it was that this floating basket and its contents were discovered by one of Pharaoh's daughter's handmaidens, a discovery eventually, of course, that led to Moses leading a privileged life and education within the palace of the Pharaoh. But things went wrong, as life, of course, happens to at times. And Moses' life underwent a huge upheaval. Because when Moses saw an Egyptian taskmaster beating a Hebrew slave, something within him just snapped. And so he, viewing the injustice of it, murdered the Egyptian and buried his body in the sand. And Moses thought he got away with it. He'd been very careful, he thought. He thought nobody would have seen what he had done, but word got out, as it so often does. And Pharaoh himself got to hear about the homicide. He personally signs the death warrant. And so Moses is left with no alternative. He has to flee the palace. He has to flee the country. He's a fugitive from justice. He runs away to Midian, where he is found working as a shepherd. And he says, at the end of Exodus chapter 2, I have become an alien in a foreign land. But God hasn't finished with Moses. One day, whilst he's tending the flock, he encounters a very strange sight, and we're going to read that story together in order to be able to put the verses that we're meant to be looking at into context. But we're going to read from the beginning part of verse 3 first of all. So if you're all with me, page 57, let's read from Exodus chapter 3. We're going to read the first 15 verses, and we're going to jump over to the beginning of chapter 4. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight. Why the bush does not burn up? When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers. I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I, that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. Then over into chapter 4, Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say the Lord did not appear to you? Then the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? A staff, he replied. The Lord said, throw it on the ground. Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. Then the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. This, said the Lord, is so that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Now, I think you've got to admit it. This story is a strange one, isn't it? It happens, interesting, doesn't it, at Moses' place of work. It happens amongst the mundane routine. It happens amongst the everyday. It happens for Moses quite literally during his wilderness years. And it's a time, it would appear, where all in, to all intents and purposes, Moses' life was going absolutely nowhere. It was a time when all of the promises, all of the possibilities of personal and political success within Egypt had now faded and seemed like a dream. Because of this encounter, I'd imagine that Moses' head was in a spin, his heart was probably beating and racing. And here he is, he's in the back of beyond, and he's having an encounter with God. He's having a very fresh, a very vivid, a very real encounter with God. It was something so unexpected. But as we discovered in the text, the encounter wasn't without purpose. Because once God's got Moses' attention, then we discover that he immediately moves on to reveal the real reason for the encounter. And first of all, God gives Moses some fresh insight into who he is. Did you see that? He increases Moses' capacity to know and to think and to understand. What he does to start with is he deals with Moses' head. And then secondly, as God reveals something of the detail of his plan, he starts to unfold what it is he wants Moses to be involved in. God starts to probe at his heart. Did you notice that? God said, look, I know the situation. I know what my people are going through. I know what they're currently facing in Egypt. God says, verse 3, if you take a look, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. But the question is, will Moses share God's concern? What's Moses' response going to be? Will he, as we considered last week, be hard-hearted, half-hearted, or wholehearted towards God and towards the plight of God's people, towards the plight of his fellow Hebrews? Well, it's at this point in the story that I find myself siding with Moses. You see, all too often, just like Moses, I shift my focus immediately away from the power of God when facing a situation that perhaps I feel is beyond me. I focus instead not on God, but on myself. I look at my inadequacies. I look at the fact that I am powerless in whatever the situation may be. And Moses' response just echoes that kind of thinking. He says, look, God, I understand what you're saying. I know what's going on. I've been there. But I need to tell you one thing, God. You've got the wrong person. You've got the wrong person. I don't have the right skills. In fact, when it comes down to it, I couldn't be less qualified for the job that you have just outlined and described in your job description. Do you know what? No one, God, is going to listen to me. They're not going to believe me. So what does God do when Moses does exactly what I tend to do at times, and probably you do, when we move from God's power to our powerlessness? God just very graciously shifts it all the way back again. He says, doesn't he, verse 12, start of it, God says, I will be with you. You see, how can Moses have forgotten so quickly the wonder and the mystery of the bush that was on fire but wasn't consumed? How can he have missed that most vital of spiritual lessons, that is the fact that wherever there is God's presence, there is God's power? They come hand in hand, inseparable. How did he miss that? Well, easily. He missed it easily because I miss it too. We all miss it. It's one of those lessons that we consistently fail to hear. Where there is God's presence, there is God's power. And then we have this amazingly abrupt change of subject. I wonder what Moses thought. The conversation's been all pretty serious and whatever, and then God just turns to him and says, what's that in your hand? Have you ever thought what a crazy question that appears to be? It's a real shift, isn't it, away from where the conversation is. We've been talking about a God who has ultimate power, and he's asking what I'm holding in my hand, as if he can't see. What is that in your hand? And Moses answer is immediate. It's straightforward. At last, a question he can answer. He says, a staff. You see, Moses, like every other Eastern shepherd, I would imagine, was never very far away from his staff. Most likely, it was roughly carved by his own hand from a carefully chosen branch of a tree. His staff was something that formed part of his identity. It was something that was part and parcel of who he was. It revealed his occupation, that of a shepherd. But more than that, it was his support. It was something he could lean on. It was a really convenient prop. But also, it was something else. It guaranteed his safety. It guaranteed the safety of his flock, those he was in charge of. He could use it, he could wield it if he needed to, or he could grab a sheep and pull it back into the flock. It was also his security. It reminded him, didn't it, that he's got a job. It reminded him of his position. The simple fact that he was employed meant that he could provide for himself and for his family. So what is that in your hand? Moses says it's a staff. God says throw it on the ground. Do you ever get to those points in stories where you think, oh, I wonder what would happen if he hadn't done that? That's the kind of thinking that sometimes I have with Scripture. I wonder what would have happened if Moses had refused and he hadn't opened his hand and he hadn't let the staff fall on the ground. What if Moses had said something like this to God? Do you know what, God? I refuse to let go of the things that this staff represents for me. I won't let go of the things that prop up my life. I need the things that I have chosen, that I have carved out for myself. I won't let go of this sense of security. This is my position. I won't let it go. I won't let go of the money I've earned. It's for me to choose what to do with it. I won't let go of the sense of safety that I arm myself with. You see, I'm all about making my own decisions, God, and living life on my terms. I simply am not going to let go. What would have been the result of that? What would have happened if Moses refused to open his hand? I wonder if countless lives would have continued to have lived in slavery with no knowledge that God had a rescue plan for their lives. That's what I wonder. But Moses does let go, doesn't he? He lets it go. He opens his hand, the staff falls to the ground, and immediately through God's power, it's transformed into a snake. And the reason it's a snake, well, you've got to read on, really. You've got to understand the context a little bit more, but I'm sure you'll be able to work out why it's a snake that it transforms into. But there's another lesson here as well, I think, that we need to understand from God's instruction in verse 3. You see, Moses' staff, whilst it represented everything that I've just said, it also represented a lot of other things as well. I think actually it represented everything that had gone wrong in his life. It represented poverty and humiliation. It represented failure. It represented fear. It was actually a daily reminder for Moses that he had to run away, that he was exiled in Midian. It was a daily reminder that he was living amongst the ashes of a life that he would have hoped would have blazed bright in the courts of Egypt. Actually, what this staff also represented was an ordinary life of an unspectacular peasant herdsman. But that is exactly the kind of life that God wishes to transform through his power. You see, spiritually speaking, God takes our failure and he transforms it through his power. He takes our ordinariness. He takes our poverty, our humiliation, our failure, and our fear, and he transforms it. That's the story of the good news of the gospel, isn't it? That's what the gospel is all about. When we're at our lowest, when we could do nothing to change our situation, when we were wandering in the wilderness, far away from God, when we were separated from him because of our wrongdoing, it was then that God chose to intervene, to demonstrate his power, to demonstrate his love, That's when he sent Jesus. That's when he set into motion a much more daring and a much more complete rescue plan than that of saving slaves from Egypt. And our journey with God isn't fully resourced unless we engage our hands as well as our heads and our hearts. And what we need to do is we need to let go of things in order for God to transform them, and it's only then that we can pick them up again and see them for what they really are. Not mine, but God's. Then we can fully appreciate what God is doing. Because God takes ordinary people and ordinary things, makes people extraordinary, and makes things extraordinary too. So where does the story of Moses' staff take him? Now, you're going to have to read on. You're going to have to just follow and trace the story through the book of Exodus if you want to, and see wherever you read about Moses' staff again. It's a really interesting thing to do. I'll leave you with a few thoughts about it. Because whenever you read of the staff again, you read of an instance where the power of God is on display alongside the vulnerability of Moses. Every time. Power of God, vulnerability of Moses. Nothing extraordinary takes place without Moses being reminded of how ordinary he is. God's power connects with our weakness in a way that we can't fully understand, but it happens when we open our hands, we let God take the things that we have, transform them, we pick them up, and we use them for his service. But just before we come to a close, there's one more important thing I'd like to leave with you. If you read on a little bit further into the story, we discover that God, in response to Moses' uncertainty, his sense of inadequacy, despite having seen God's power at work, well, God says, well, perhaps it'd be a good idea if you don't travel alone. What a great thing. What a great thing that is. God says, I think the best thing, Moses, would be if you had a companion for the journey. You know, during this series, throughout this year, we've been focusing on what it means to be a disciple. And we've seen over and over again that being a follower of Jesus isn't a solitary journey. I wonder if you've ever thought what the plural of disciple is. What's the plural of disciple? This isn't an English lesson. But what's the plural of disciple? I'll let you think about that for a moment. If you look into the New Testament, we read about Jesus' disciples. We've been doing that as we've gone through Luke. We look into the Gospels, what do we find? Disciple. Disciples. Sounds like the plural to me. We get into Acts, what do we find? Well, we find a little bit more about talk about disciples, some talk about disciples. We get into the letters. Oh, that's strange. The word's almost gone. It's gone. Because the plural of disciple is church. That's where it's gone. The plural of disciple is church. I wonder what God is asking you to throw onto the ground. I wonder what God is asking all of us to throw onto the ground, to have it transformed and to pick it up for his service. I wonder what those things could be, individually or collectively. I wonder where God is leading us to be salt and light. I wonder, what are the resources that we are holding on to that we're refusing to let go? Because they're our prop, our support, our security. I wonder where God wishes us to go. You know, do we wish to lead our lives with closed or open hands? I guess that's the real question. If we live our lives with open hands, then God has promised to use the ordinariness of our lives in extraordinary ways. If you look in your focus this week, you'll find a very short book review of this book, The Selfish Gospel by Freddie Pym. John Allen's written the review, and it's glowing. It's a glowing review. So it's a good book. John loves it, and so do many of us who've read it. But this is what he has to say. and I'll finish with this quote. The process of kingdom building starts with the process of discipleship, a transformation towards Christ's likeness, allowing him to build his kingdom in our hearts so that we are changed. As we grow in that kingdom, it starts to spill out of us. We start looking for ways to build the kingdom in our society. We start looking for opportunities to restore people to right relationship with God and to right relationship with each other. That is the work of God through ordinary lives. That's the work that can only be done as we get our heads and our hearts and our hands fully engaged in the spirit-filled business, the family business of making disciples. Let's pray together as we close. Heavenly Father, we do sincerely pray that our lives may be lived wholly for you, that our heads and our hearts and our hands may be occupied, may be at work, not only as we become disciples more worthy of the one that we follow, but also as we seek to make disciples.